When a brutal murder rocks a small town in Georgia, everyone is shocked. Did the new guy in town do it? Yes, the cops say, and they quickly land him in prison. But then another murder happens, and another. In the end, 4 bodies, 2 convictions, and 1 man in jail for a crime he likely did not commit. Welcome to Murderville, Murderville, Georgia, a new investigative podcast from The Intercept. Subscribe now on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. The missing persons poster read, Jerry Williams, also known as Mike Williams, was last seen leaving his residence in the vicinity of the 5,000 block of Centennial Oak Circle in Tallahassee, Florida. He allegedly was going duck hunting at Lake Seminole. His boat and vehicle, described as a green and tan 1994 Ford Bronco, were later found at the lake as well. The poster, which had started circulating in late December of 2000, went on to say that Mike went missing on December 16, 2000, that he was 31 years old, a white male with brown hair and blue eyes. Distinguishing characteristics included a chickenpox scar on his left cheek, previously worn braces on his teeth, and corrective shoes. He was possibly wearing camouflage hunting clothes and may have also been wearing a St. Christopher medal on a gold chain, a watch, and a wedding band on his left finger. The poster asked anyone who had any information concerning the case to please contact the Jackson County Sheriff's Office. But the thing was, no one would be contacting the Jackson County Sheriff's Office about this case. No one with a viable lead anyway. And in fact, 17 years would go by before Mike's best friend, Brian Winchester, would testify in court that he had killed him. Brian would go on to describe a gruesome scene after loading Mike's body into his vehicle.
I went back out to the driveway to leave. When I went out to the driveway, my driveway was angled, and I was walking behind my truck, and I saw out of the back tailgate, blood was coming out of the back of my tailgate and dripping onto the driveway. And that freaked me out. So I rinsed that off and was trying to figure out. I'd been thinking on the way from Lake Seminole back to Tallahassee, what was I going to do with him? And I don't know when I decided, but, you know, ultimately I decided it had to be close and it had to be quick. And it had to be obviously a location that, you know, he wouldn't be found.
This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 65. In the early morning hours of December 16th, 2000, Mike Williams did indeed intend to go duck hunting with his best friend, Brian Winchester. They often went hunting together. And in fact, they often did lots of things together. They had grown up in the same town, attended the same schools, and their wives, Denise, Mike's wife, and Kathy, Brian's wife, were friends, and they even each had a small child around the same age. On this morning, however, something was different. Brian had suggested to Mike that they go to a secret special spot he knew of, and had told Mike to make sure he brought his waders with him. Waders being a waterproof rubber boot that extends from the foot to the chest. Mike met up with Brian at a gas station and then followed him to Lake Seminole, a reservoir located on the very southwestern corner of Georgia. They pulled into the boat landing and launched the boat. Brian told Mike they needed to put their waders on, and so they did. Brian then got into the back of the boat so he could drive. Mike was in the front. What Mike didn't know that morning was that Brian was nervous. He had a plan that was very different than what Mike thought they were going to do. But Brian was concerned about timing. Everything was taking longer than he had anticipated, and he was supposed to be back in town soon to meet up with his father-in-law. It was a prearranged alibi. An alibi, so no one would suspect that he had ever been with Mike that morning. Brian drove the boat into a deep area and told Mike to stand up. And when he did, Brian got up and gave Mike a hard shove, effectively shoving him overboard and into the water. It was dark out, and he could tell that Mike was thrashing around in the water, but couldn't tell exactly what he was doing. He didn't appear to be drowning as he had anticipated. Brian reached down and picked up the gun he had brought and loaded it. He drove the boat around Mike, circling him like prey, and as he passed by him, he pointed his gun and pulled the trigger. When word got around later that afternoon that Mike was missing, the Florida Wildlife Commission, along with Mike's friends and family, started searching for him. They found his boat, which had washed up on the west shore, and his Bronco and trailer. They knew Mike had gone hunting that morning, but they were under the impression that he had gone alone, and they had no idea why he hadn't returned. The days passed and the searches continued. The community felt for Mike's wife, Denise, and their young daughter. Adding to the tragedy was the fact that Mike and Denise had plans to celebrate their 6th wedding anniversary on the day Mike had gone missing. There were extensive searches at Lake Seminole, searches that Brian participated in, with everyone around him believing that he was distraught, desperate, and willing to stop at nothing to find his best friend. Nothing turned up until 6 months after Mike's disappearance, when suddenly a pair of waders, a jacket, a flashlight, and a hunting license belonging to Mike was found. But there was something odd about the items. All of them were in excellent condition. They certainly didn't look like they had been in the water for 6 months, and the flashlight even still worked. But despite how hard they searched, Mike's body was never recovered. Investigators seemed to believe that there had been a tragic boating accident, that Mike had gone hunting alone, and that his boat had hit a stump, causing him to go overboard and drown in his waders. And perhaps they couldn't find his body because it had been eaten by alligators. They repeated this theory to reporters. 1 week after Mike's personal belongings were found, his wife Denise filed a petition in court. She cited the fact that his clothing and hunting license had been found and asked to have him legally declared dead. There were life insurance policies totaling more than $1.5 million, and Denise had a family to support after all. Mike and Denise had also grown up together and were high school sweethearts. Mike was the popular football player and Denise, the pretty cheerleader. They graduated high school in 1988, attended Florida State University, and married in 1994. Those who knew Mike knew him to be hardworking. Before he had even graduated, Mike had accepted a position as a property appraiser. By all accounts, Mike was a devoted husband and father. He and Denise welcomed a baby girl in 1999. She was just 18 months old when Mike disappeared. In some cases, this might be the end of the story, a presumed boating accident with the ongoing theory that Mike's body was tragically eaten by alligators, and his family, his devastated wife and young daughter, left to pick up the pieces without him. But that's not where this story ends at all. In fact, it picks up about 5 years later, when, much to many people following the case's surprise, Mike's wife, Denise, marries Mike's best friend and killer, Brian Winchester. It was something of a shock to investigators who had opened up a cold case investigation into Mike's disappearance. Sure, it could be that Mike's best friend and wife had grown close while comforting each other over their loss. Or it could be something more sinister. But investigators didn't have any physical evidence to prove that anything was amiss with Mike's disappearance. Back when Mike first went missing, the initial team of investigators didn't find anything suspicious about it, and any items they found that had belonged to Mike had long been returned to his family. But still, they told reporters that they no longer believed that there had been an accident, that they now suspected foul play, and even had suspects in mind. And it wasn't just the investigators who had their suspicions. Mike's mother, Cheryl, was convinced that her son hadn't just died in a boating accident, and she wasn't about to be quiet about her suspicions either. In May 2006, she took out an ad in the Tallahassee Democrat with a picture of Mike and a large headline that read, "My son is missing. Please help me find him." The ad went on to say, quote, "On the morning of December 16th, 2000, my son, Jerry Michael Williams, supposedly went duck hunting at Lake Seminole in Sneeds, Florida. He never returned. At the time of Mike's disappearance, he was 31 years old. He had duck hunted at Lake Seminole for many years. When he did not return from hunting that day, the authorities assumed he drowned and that alligators ate his body. No criminal investigation was done at the time." The ad continued, quote, "80 people have drowned in Lake Seminole since the late 1800s. Mike's body is the only one that has never been found. Reptile experts have told me that alligators don't hunt or eat in December because the water is too cold. I do not believe my son died in Lake Seminole." Cheryl Williams also worked with a reporter at the Tallahassee Democrat to keep Mike's name in the news. She would give various tidbits about the disappearance, but would stop short of accusing Brian or Denise. When reporters contacted Brian and Denise to get their take on the matter, they declined to comment, instead saying in an email that they loved Mike, but just wanted their privacy. But everything would change in August of 2016, turning the entire case onto its head. On August 5th, 2016, Denise Williams walked into the Tallahassee Police Department and said she had been kidnapped at gunpoint. She told detectives that she had just gotten into her car that had been parked in her driveway when someone crawled out of the back and held a gun up to her ribs.
"I was calling my sister, and this person starts climbing out of the very back, and I couldn't tell at first who it was, but then immediately I knew who it was, but I was screaming, and the phone helped me. I didn't know if she had picked up yet or not, and then he grabbed the phone, so I don't know if he turned it off. I don't know how. I never saw the phone again. He, you know, was up and grabbing me, and he pulled my face pretty hard, and he goes, you know, he's cussing, and he pulled out a gun, not a hunting gun, but like a gun he would kill someone with, and he put it right here in my ribs."
Her assailant was none other than Brian Winchester, her now estranged husband, who she was in the process of divorcing. She said that as she drove, Brian hovered over her, saying, "I just want to talk to you. I just want to talk to you." He held her against her will for over an hour, telling her that he had been emailing and texting her, trying to talk her out of divorcing him, but she wouldn't talk to him, and so he had to do this. He told her that he had lost everything and had nothing to live for. Denise told the detectives that she tried calming him down and that she told him that she knows he loves her and wants to talk to her, but that this wasn't the right way to do it. She said she just started agreeing with him and told him that if he turns his life around and goes back to the Lord, he could get her back. She said he eventually calmed down and let her go after she agreed not to call the police. She was scared of him, she told the detectives, and wanted to press charges. After hearing about the kidnapping, one of the cold case investigators who had been assigned to Mike's disappearance, Special Agent Mike Devaney, decided to go to the Tallahassee Police Department and listen in on Denise's interview. And afterwards, he went into the room and told her that he wanted to talk to her about Mike's disappearance. By this point, he had suspicions, not only about Brian's involvement, but also about Denise's. He told her that they believed Brian had intended on killing her that day, and he asked her where Brian had tried to get her to drive to. She said he kept telling her to turn by the roundabout, but that she wasn't really paying attention to that. Agent Devaney then asked her another question.
"Where do you think Mike's buried at?"
"Oh, I have no idea."
"Any speculation on that?"
"On where he's buried?"
"Buried.
I mean, I believe..."
"You don't really believe he died at... on the lake?"
"I do."
"Why?"
I just always have. That's what I believe. And I have, from what he was saying roundabout, I don't know, I talked with the last two people, and I can't remember if he wanted me to turn left or right.
That's not what I'm talking about. Why do you think Mike perished in the lake? Because he didn't die Lake Seminole, okay?
That's what I've always believed. That's what I believe.
And why?
I've never been proven anything different. I don't...
Well, has there been any proof he drowned? If he would have perished in that lake, he would have been found. Okay? There's never been a person that has fallen over whatever that they've never found except for Mike. I mean, that's literally, it's an impossibility that he died in that lake.
I guess to... That's just what I believe.
Really?
Agent Devaney told her that they had come to the conclusion that Mike did not die on Lake Seminole, and that they had been hoping that one day either she or Brian could fill in some of the gaps for them. Denise responded that her focus was on what had just happened to her and on getting a restraining order against Brian. Agent Devaney reassured her that they were going to arrest Brian for what he did, that she didn't have to worry about that. Denise said she still didn't want to talk about Mike, that she wanted to go and file a restraining order before the end of the day.
I want to get this settled first.
This is settled.
It's not settled to me, though. I have not gone down. I have not filed the restraining order, and that's what is pressing on me so bad. So I understand that you want to talk about this, but this is what I want to do. This is what has to be done.
Yeah.
Today.
You got some time. We're almost done. All right. You know why it's so important to talk to you about Mike? This was your husband. He simply vanished. Hopefully you still have an interest in that.
Well, again, this is my priority right now. I'm not comfortable talking about this right now. I've had an unbelievable day. And it's just all too much right now. I really want to focus on it.
Has it sunk in that you literally saved your own life today?
All I know is I was praying.
Agent Devaney said they were seeing a side of Brian that investigators knew was there. Denise responded that she had never seen that side of him before.
Do you think he's responsible for Mike's disappearance?
I do not, and I never have. I would have never married him if I thought that. I would have never wanted so bad to have children with him. In my mind and in my heart, no. David is my brother-in-law. He was just in here talking to me about trying to get me to understand that, you know, that my life was in danger today.
Absolutely.
And then having me to look back on that whole situation now from a different point of view. And I'm definitely going to do that. But do I believe right here in this moment that he had anything to do with that? Absolutely not. Does that mean that I'm not going to process this and then go back? Of course I am. But I've got to process this first. And I know you understand that.
The interview ended shortly after, with Agent Devaney telling her, "I hope it's sinking in how bad this could have been." Brian was arrested a short time later and charged with kidnapping, domestic assault, and armed burglary. In Denise's petition for domestic violence protection, she wrote, quote, "I believe and I know that Brian will kill me and or my child if he is released." She also wrote, "I would never wish this on anyone. I can't sleep. I can't eat. I can't close my eyes because I always see him rising up out of the back of the car, screaming and waving a gun. I can't relax because all I can feel is the gun shoved in my ribs. I can't have peace because I only hear his voice screaming and cussing at me." After hearing the news, Cheryl Williams told reporters that she hoped the new development would somehow solve her son's case. She said of Brian and Denise, "They're the only two people that profited from Mike's disappearance." She went on to say that she hopes that one of them will crack, and said that sooner or later, one will turn on the other. Cheryl had no way of knowing for certain just how right she was. In October 2017, a little over a year after Brian's arrest, He pleaded no contest to kidnapping and burglary with a firearm. Denise went to court a couple months later and testified against him. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison. But Denise was about to be in for quite a shock, because little did she know, just as Cheryl Williams had predicted, Brian had started cooperating with police about Mike's disappearance. And in fact, Brian had confessed to killing Mike, even leading them to Mike's remains, which were found more than 50 miles from Lake Seminole. But according to Brian, he hadn't acted alone. According to Brian, he and Denise had been having an affair for years and had been planning Mike's demise for months. And not only that, but he said Denise was the one who had really wanted him to do it. He told police, quote, "I had a good wife, I had a kid, and I had Denise on the side. This is messed up thinking, but in my mind, I had it pretty good. Denise and Mike, on the other hand, they were at each other's throats, and she had 2 million reasons for this to happen." Then he gave what he said was the reason he kidnapped Denise. After they had separated, he said he was paranoid that she was going to turn him into the police, so he held her at gunpoint and made her promise to take their secret to the grave. In May 2018, Denise was booked into the Leon County Jail, charged with first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit first-degree murder, and accessory after the fact. Brian, on the other hand, scored quite a deal with prosecutors. If he testified against Denise and told the truth about what happened, he would receive immunity and wouldn't be charged with the murder. Denise's attorney, Ethan Way, told reporters before a trial that his client had nothing to do with what Brian Winchester did. Quote, "We will fight this until the end, and I'm certain when a jury hears from Denise Williams and the facts come out, the inescapable conclusion is that Brian Winchester killed Mike Williams." In his opening statements, Assistant State's Attorney John Fuchs told the jury that Brian and Denise had been having an affair and that they plotted to kill Mike. He said there were three individual insurance policies and that Brian, an insurance salesman, had actually sold Mike the $1 million policy. And while Brian and Mike talked about the policies, Brian and Denise were talking about how they could be together. He said Denise didn't want to be a divorcee, that she was from a religious family and didn't like the stigma. So they talked about killing both Mike and Kathy, Brian's wife. They talked about going fishing on the boat and that somehow Mike and Kathy would fall overboard and miraculously Denise and Brian would be the ones who would be rescued. But Brian said no to that plan because he didn't want to kill the mother of his child. So they settled on just killing Mike. Denise liked the sound of being a widow, Fuchs said. She would get more sympathy for that and could be the center of attention. One of the insurance policies was set to expire in March, so they knew they had to kill Mike before then. They also knew they had to make it look like an accident. Fuchs said that waders are notorious for being dangerous if you fall out of a boat. They fill up with water and you can drown. So they came up with a plan for Brian and Mike to go hunting in the dark, and Brian would then push Mike overboard in his waders, and he would drown. Mike and Denise were supposed to go and celebrate their anniversary on the day he disappeared, but Denise was in a secret relationship with Brian and didn't want to go, so they decided to do it then. They discussed how to do it and how to set up their alibis. Fuchs told the jury that they would be hearing from Brian Winchester, and he said Brian's story would be corroborated. He said that in October of 2017, Brian confessed to murdering Mike. And he took police to Carr Lake, where he had buried Mike all those years ago. Officers had to cut away trees, pump the water out, and then they found Mike exactly where Brian said he would be. And the autopsy confirmed that Mike was shot in the head, just like Brian said. Fuchs displayed X-ray photos of Mike's head to the jury. Then X-ray photos of Mike's arms and hands were displayed, where on his left ring finger, there was a small circle. Mike still had his wedding ring on, Fuchs said. He told the jury that investigators worked to verify Brian's story, and they talked to his ex-wife and Denise's friend, Kathy. Kathy and Denise had remained close friends all these years, even despite the fact that Brian and Denise had married. Kathy agreed to work with law enforcement and to try to record her conversations with Denise. "You won't hear flat-out admissions," he said, but Kathy does confront her about a mysterious message Denise tried to send to Brian after he was arrested. Fuchs put Denise's mugshot up on the screen and asked the jury to find her guilty. End the 21 years of their sex, lies, and deceit, and find her guilty of these particular crimes. Denise's other attorney, Philip Petavano, told the jury that they wouldn't be disputing the fact that Mike Williams was murdered or that Brian, a man he thought was his friend, was the one who killed him. "But Brian is not on trial," he said. "And in fact, Brian has never even been charged with the murder." He told them that since Brian was granted immunity, he can testify as he pleases, without any fear that the state will be able to use that testimony against him. "You will have to decide whether to believe him," Padovano said, saying that Brian's testimony is totally uncorroborated. And he said that aside from Brian's testimony, there is no other evidence against Denise.
In plain English, there isn't anything to back it up. You're not going to hear evidence from a witness who said that he or she saw Denise Williams participating in the planning or the execution of this murder. You're not going to hear any witness talk about DNA evidence or fingerprint evidence. There's no tangible evidence or physical evidence to connect Denise Williams to this crime. No confession, no admission, nothing.
He said Denise and Mike had a happy marriage, by all accounts, and that there was no reason why Denise would be unhappy with him. Mike was a good husband, father, and provider, he said. In May 1999, after Mike and Denise's daughter was born, Mike started inquiring about increasing his insurance. His advisor told him that he should have at least $1 million in life insurance. Brian and his dad were insurance agents and had sold Mike a smaller policy earlier. So when Mike got this advice, he went back to Brian and his dad to get a bigger policy. Padovano said there was no evidence that Denise participated in any of those discussions about insurance or that she did anything to influence Mike to buy it. He told the jury that there is evidence that contradicts Brian's story. For example, there's strong evidence that Brian tried very hard to stay married to Kathy after the murder, even begging her to take him back at their final divorce hearing. And Denise had gotten into a serious relationship with another man, a man named Chuck Bunker, after the murder. Brian and Denise did get married, but that was 5 years after her husband disappeared, he said. They separated in 2012, and in 2015, Denise filed for divorce. Brian tried to save their marriage but couldn't. And in a final, desperate attempt, he decided to kidnap her. Padovano then described the kidnapping, saying that at about 2:30 a.m. on August 5th, 2016, Brian climbed into the cargo area of Denise's SUV. He then waited for her to get up and leave to go to work. He was armed with a gun, a tarp, and 2 containers of bleach. Fortunately for Denise, she was able to calm him down by promising that they would work it out, although she had no intentions to. Instead, she went straight to the police and he was arrested for armed kidnapping. Padovano said that Brian has a motive to lie and to make up these allegations against Denise. He didn't mention anything about her alleged participation in Mike's murder until after he realized Denise was going to ask the court for a life sentence. So at that point, he made an agreement for immunity, which ensured that the state would not ask for a life sentence and guaranteed that anything he said about Mike couldn't be used against him. Padovano said he also wanted to get revenge on Denise. He asked the court to find her not guilty. Scott Dungy was one of the first witnesses for the state. His testimony was pre-recorded and was shown to the jury on a screen. He said he was a longtime friend of Mike and Denise's, but that Mike was one of his closest friends. He said he helped search for Mike every day from December through February. He never missed a day. He said his hope was that Mike had fallen out of his boat and swam to the other side of the island. He was hoping they would find him alive. At one point, he was up in a helicopter searching and noticed a lot of alligators swimming. 6 months after Mike's disappearance, he was there when waders, a jacket, a flashlight, and Mike's hunting license were found. He said the items were all in excellent shape. Tully Sparkman, an investigator with the state's attorney's office, testified that he was assigned to the case in 2007. He was taking over for an investigator who had recently left. He said he found it odd that they never found Mike's body, that it had never floated up. He said they had never not recovered a body after someone went missing in that lake. He said he eventually became aware that Denise and Brian had gotten married.
Did that factor into your into the suspicious nature of all this?
Yes, it was a suspicious matter, of course, yes.
Investigator Sparkman said they started reinvestigating the case, looking into financial records, phone records, conducting interviews, and following up on leads. They subpoenaed phone records but couldn't get them because the phone companies only kept them for so long. After 7 years, they purged them, and they were outside of that time frame. He said they started trying to gather all the evidence that had been collected in the case, but they could only find some items. They found the boat, but couldn't find the waders or the jacket. They got copies of the death certificate, signed on June 9th, 2001, about 6 months after Mike went missing. He said he learned of the insurance payouts to Denise, which heightened his suspicions. He noted that the date of marriage on Denise and Brian's marriage certificate was December 3rd, 2005, 13 days from the anniversary of Mike's death. We'll get into more trial testimony right after this quick break from today's sponsors. The original True Body Bra by TrueAndCo.com is the bra women are talking about. Over 500,000 women have bought it and swear by it, including yours truly. You won't believe how good the True Body Bra looks when you put it on. The buttery, soft fabric smooths you out in all the right places, and it has no wires, so it's super comfortable. But unlike other wire-free bras, the original True Body Bra is made with proprietary fabric that still gives you the support you need. It took over 6 years of collecting data from 7 million women to make this game-changing bra, so it's no surprise that TrueAndCo.com has sold over 500,000 of the original True Body Bras. It just goes to show that great things happen when women come together. The Today Show calls it game-changing, and Good Housekeeping says it's the ultimate lounge bra. And actually, the ultimate lounge bra description is pretty accurate. I record this podcast from home, and it is my full-time job. And after I'm done working, I always go and play with my six-month-old daughter. The very last thing I want to worry about while I'm doing any of those things is an uncomfortable bra, which can be extremely distracting. The True Body Bra is so comfortable that I even forget I have it on. And you can try the original True Body Bra from True & Co. today with free and easy returns. And save 15% now when you go to trueandco.com/junkie and enter the code JUNKIE. That's TRUEANDCO.com/junkie. Simple Contacts lets you conveniently renew your contact lens prescription and reorder your contacts from anywhere in minutes. It's vision care for the 21st century. The Simple Contacts vision test is self-guided and takes less than 5 minutes. It isn't a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam, but it will save you so much time when you need to renew and reorder. It's designed by ophthalmologists and a licensed doctor reviews every test, so you skip the office visit, but not the care. Simple Contacts has all the brands and types of lenses you're familiar with, so you never have to shop around to find your lenses at the best price. And best of all, Simple Contacts saves you money. The vision test is only $20, their contact lens prices are unbeatable, and standard shipping is free. As you guys likely know by now, I love Simple Contacts. There really couldn't be a more easy and more affordable way to reorder my contact lenses. Their vision test just takes a few minutes, and then they do all the heavy lifting. I've saved so much money, time, and even saved myself the annoyance of having to go to the eye doctor just to reorder my lenses. Get $20 off your contacts at simplecontacts.com/junkie20 or enter code junkie20 at checkout. That's simplecontacts.com/junkie20 or enter code junkie20 at checkout to get $20 off your contacts. Michael Devaney, a special agent with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, or FDLE, said he was assigned to the case in 2010. He saw that the status of the investigation had changed to a suspicious missing persons case in 2004. Back then, investigators couldn't prove that it was a homicide, but they had noted that a lot of things didn't make sense for it to have been an accidental death. In December 2010, he said they brought all the investigators together to go over the case. They had developed two persons of interest, Denise and Brian.
And what is it that made them possible suspects or suspicious?
Well, you have to go back. There were several things. The investigators that were assigned to this case, including myself, we were very uneasy about the insurance situation. We realized it was Brian that reached out to try to find out what it would take to get Mike declared dead. It was Brian that did that. We found out that Brian actually sold $1 million insurance policy to Mike just before his death. That needed to be researched. We had problems
Let me stop you right there. Talking about the insurance policy, was Brian a benefactor of the insurance policy?
I believe he was.
Did the payout go to him or to go to Denise?
Denise.
Okay. So the payout of the insurance policy would be to Denise.
Yes, sir.
But despite their suspicions, he said the case was still a cold case and they didn't have enough evidence to make any arrests. Agent Devaney told the jury about his interview with Denise in August of 2016, after she reported the kidnapping to police.
And when you asked her about his involvement in Mike Williams, she says, certainly not.
Correct.
No.
Yeah, I tried to convince her that everything that was gathered and all the information that was there, that that certainly could have been the last day of her life. I was trying to impress upon her this, but it didn't seem to connect.
At any point did she say, you know, all these years later, I never believed you would have, but given what happened today, maybe it was true?
No, sir.
Nothing along those lines?
No, sir.
Flat out denial?
Denial.
But according to Brian's testimony, Denise did know that he had killed Mike. Brian took the stand next and right away called Mike a very good friend. He said he and Denise had actually started their affair back in 1997, about 3 years before the murder. He said he had discovered that his wife, Kathy, had been cheating on him, and that's what led him to eventually end up being with Denise.
We all started going out a lot. My wife and I, Kathy and Denise and Mike, we started going out to bars and concerts and drinking and doing a lot of things that we didn't really do while we were all in college, when probably it's more appropriate to do those sorts of things. But we started going out, a lot of drinking, and I remember one night in particular, there were several nights that we did this, but one night in particular, we started talking about sex a lot, the four of us. And I was friends with Denise in middle school and high school, but I was never attracted to her until that point. And so after we started talking about sexual things and things that married couples shouldn't be talking about with each other, I think that's when the spark kind of started between the two of us.
He said he and Denise considered their anniversary to be October 13th, 1997.
We were going out, like I said, going out a lot. And one night in particular, we were going to Floyd's. And so Denise and I, we pulled up on Tennessee Street, And Denise and I jumped out of the car and left Mike and Kathy to go park the car and went down to the entrance of Floyd's. And that was the first place that we like kissed each other and made out. And we had our night out. And then after we all went home, to our separate houses.
Let me stop you right there. You and Denise made out that night, but Mike and Kathy were present?
They were in the car. They were parking the car. It was while they were gone parking the car. And
who
so
was there that night?
Just the four of us. And so later that night, after Kathy and I went home and Mike and Denise went home, she and I got on the phone together. And we basically spent the whole night talking to each other on the phone. And it was just like, I don't know, we connected like nobody else. I mean, we just really connected. And we had a lot of sexual talk and had phone sex and that sort of thing. And we agreed and then met up the next day. I think we just met during her lunch break at work. And that's kind of what just started the whole ball rolling with her and I.
It all snowballed really fast, he said. They met at hotels, and during the workday, whenever Mike was at work, they had sex very regularly. Mike was a workaholic, he said, and Denise wasn't happy about that. He said they eventually started going on trips together, and that Denise and Mike would go on vacation, where Mike would have a conference to attend, and Brian would go there too and meet up with her. Their sexual relationship continued after Mike's death. He said that on one occasion, after Mike died, he went out with a friend named Angela and ended up sleeping with her. All of a sudden, while he and Angela were together, the light came on in the bedroom and Denise was standing there. He said he lied to Angela and told her that he thought it was his ex-wife, Kathy, and then he ran after her. Part of Brian's job was to sell life insurance. He said he sold Mike two different policies, one right after they graduated college before he was married to Denise, and another one after Mike and Denise's daughter was born. He was asked if he and Denise started planning Mike's murder in the year 2000.
I think it even started prior to that. As I've thought about this and had plenty of time alone to think about it, one thing that I have remembered is the prior year, Mike and I were on a hunting trip together. And it was at a lake that was dry, and we had to walk across the mud. And there were places in the mud where, I don't know how to describe it, but basically you could fall through the mud and there was nothing underneath. It was like, it was basically, I guess people would call it like quicksand. And Mike fell into one of those mud holes at one time. And it was just he and I out there. And I helped him out of it. And he had dropped his gun in there as well. And he ended up going back in it after his gun. Anyways, I remember telling Denise about that and how if I hadn't have been there or if I hadn't helped him out, that, you know, it's very likely he would have disappeared and nobody would have known what happened to him. But that's just something that I had remembered in the past few months and thinking about this. But I think it was gradual that we, you know, the more we were together, the more we wanted to be together. And the more we griped about Kathy and Mike, the more we wanted to be together.
He said Denise was adamant that she would not get a divorce. He said this narrowed their options.
One of the options, Mike worked a lot at night up at his office. And one of the options was that we could make it look as if there was a burglary of some sort up at his office and that he got shot in some type of robbery or something up at his office. Denise didn't like that idea. I didn't like that idea, and Denise didn't like that idea, but primarily because there would be an investigation if something like that occurred. So another idea, we all used to go out on boats a lot, and Mike had a boat. And another option was that
The four of us would go out on a boat out into the Gulf.
The four of you being who?
Me and Kathy and Denise and Mike. And we'd go out in a boat on the Gulf. And basically that Kathy and Mike would be pushed overboard and that Denise and I would find a buoy way offshore that we could hold on to and either let the boat sink or let the boat take off on its own or whatever and make it look like we had an accident on the water and that Denise and I had survived the accident.
He said eventually it was decided that only Mike would die. In fact, he said, he never wanted Kathy to die.
I had no desire whatsoever for anything to happen to Kathy. I didn't really emphasize that with Denise because it was not good for me to express affection or, you know, care about what happened to Kathy with Denise. But silently to myself, I was never going to allow anything to happen to my son's mom.
Brian said Denise's biggest thing was that she didn't want to share custody of their daughter if she and Mike were to get divorced. So they decided to go ahead with the drowning while hunting plan. He said it had to be during the duck season and it couldn't be at any of the shallow local lakes. So they decided on Lake Seminole because it was a lot deeper. He said Denise didn't have to do a whole lot for their plan to work. She just had to come up with an alibi for herself and to make sure that Mike went on the hunting trip. He said 1 week prior to Mike's murder, they had initially set the trip up for that weekend. But late the night before midnight, Mike called him and told him that he couldn't go because Denise didn't want him to go. Brian said he was shocked because they had already made the plans. He called Denise immediately after he hung up with Mike to see what was going on. He said he didn't want her to be wishy-washy about it. He told the jury that Denise got cold feet at the last minute, and so they had several more conversations. Either we're going to go forward with this or not. Either we're going to be together or not, he said. He said he wasn't happy that she was backing out at the last second. They decided to move forward with the plan 1 week later. The night before, he and his wife Kathy went to a concert. He said part of the plan was to get Kathy as drunk as possible so she would sleep in the next morning. He said the plan was to do it early in the morning, and then he would have enough time to get back and meet his father-in-law to go hunting, which would then be his alibi. Denise would be at home with her daughter, and when Mike didn't come home, she would start calling her sister and dad from her house phone so she could prove that she was at home. Brian said that he and Kathy went to the concert the night before and got home late, and that Kathy did have a lot to drink. He said he and Denise had talked about giving Kathy some sort of medication so she would be in a heavy sleep, but he couldn't remember if they did it that night or the week prior. The next morning, he met up with Mike at a gas station. Brian had told him that they were going to go to a secret special spot to go hunting and that they needed to use their waders. He said there's a duck hunter's myth that if you fall overboard with your waders on, you'll sink and drown. So he had to make sure that Mike brought them and put them on. Mike followed him to Lake Seminole, and they pulled into the landing and launched the boat. They got to a deep area, and he said he got Mike to stand up. He doesn't remember what he said to get him to stand up, but when he did, he pushed Mike into the water.
He was in the water. And he was, like, struggling. And the motor of the boat was still running. And I pulled off just a little bit to get kind of away from him so that he couldn't reach back into the boat. And I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know if he was trying to swim or I didn't know what was going on, but what I came to find out or eventually realized was he was taking the waders and the jacket off. And he got those off. And I think I forgot to tell you about this part before, but I remember now that that area of the lake had a lot of snags, a lot of dead trees that come up out of the water, and there's a lot of stumps that come up out of the water. And he swam over to one of those stumps and held on to it. And he was panicking, and I was panicking. And none of this was like going how I thought it was going to go. And I didn't know what to do. But he started to yell, and I didn't know how to get out of that situation. And so I had my gun in the boat, and so I loaded my gun, and I made one or two circles around, and I ended up circling closer towards him, and he was in the water, and as I passed by, I shot him.
Brian wiped his eyes with a tissue before continuing.
So when I shot him, it was dark, and there was a bright flash when that happened. And I didn't want to see what happened. So like I closed my eyes when the instant of that flash happened. And the boat was moving as this happened. And so I turned back around and came back to where he was and got to the stump. And I knew I couldn't leave him there being shot. So I was going to have to do something to cover this up.
He said he reached down into the water and grabbed him. There was another landing close by, so he drove the boat over there, dragging Mike along in the water. He got out, ran back to where their cars were parked, and drove his truck to the edge of the water. He put Mike in the back and then pushed the boat back out into the water. He didn't really think that far into what he was doing. He just wanted to get out of the area as fast as he could. He was asked how he was able to load Mike into his truck, being that Mike was a little bigger than him.
It was not easy. And it was not pretty, but I had to make it happen. I mean, I had no choice. And I can't even explain like how your body feels in that kind of a situation. I don't, unless somebody's been to war or something, I don't even know how to explain, but like you have so much adrenaline pumping through your body. It's just crazy. But, you know, it wasn't pretty, and I made a purposeful decision to never view him, to look at him. But I backed the truck down, and there was an angle to the ramp, so the back of my truck was angled down toward the water, and I backed it all the way down to the edge of the water, so there was no distance involved. But yes, he was very heavy, and it was not easy to do that, but I had no choice.
He sped back towards Tallahassee. He realized he wasn't going to make it in time to meet his father-in-law, but he didn't want to call him because he didn't want that to show up on his phone records. He went to the parking lot where they were supposed to meet, but by the time he got there, his father-in-law was gone. So he decided the only thing he could do was to go back home and hop in bed and pretend like he had overslept. Kathy was still sleeping when he got home, so he crawled back into bed. From there, he called his father-in-law and told him he had overslept.
I didn't want to wake Kathy up, obviously, because I had what was in the driveway, but I wanted her to know I was there. So I can't remember what I said to her, but I think I halfway woke her up and said, I'm going to go out with the dogs or train dogs. I trained dogs at the time. I was gone for hours at a time from the house doing stuff like that. But I don't remember exactly what I told her, but I wanted her to I wanted her to know that I was there, to confirm that I was there, but not wake up and start asking me any questions about what happened, why'd you oversleep, you know, anything like that. So I did that. And then I went back out to the driveway to leave. When I went out to the driveway, my driveway was angled and I was walking behind my truck and I saw out of the back tailgate, blood was coming out of the back of my tailgate and dripping onto the driveway. And that freaked me out. So I rinsed that off and was trying to figure out. I'd been thinking on the way from Lake Seminole back to Tallahassee, what was I going to do with him? And I don't know when I decided, but, you know, ultimately I decided it had to be close and it had to be quick. And it had to be obviously a location that, you know, he wouldn't be found.
He ultimately decided to bury Mike's body in a mud hole at Carr Lake. He went to Walmart and bought a shovel, a tarp, and weights. While he was there, he said he ran into a friend of his, Mike Phillips, who later told him that he had seemed to be in a panic. He remarked to the jury that Mike Phillips had thought he was in a panic because he was going to go help search for Mike, but that really, he was going to bury Mike. Brian dug a hole in an area he considered to be hidden. He said he was exhausted and kept getting bitten by ants as he dug. He put Mike's body in the hole and covered him up. His truck had blood all over the back of it, so he went to his parents' house and parked in the back of their lot. He used a hose to try and clean out the back of the truck, but it wasn't working very well. So he left there and went to a car wash that had pressure washers. He cleaned out the back the best he could with those. He said his dad called him later that night as he was driving back home and told him that Mike was missing. He and his dad went over to Lake Seminole, where Mike's friends and family were out searching. They went out onto the lake and searched for Mike, he said, as he made the quotation sign with his fingers. He then broke into hysterics.
There was a storm that came through that night. I think we got off the lake before that happened, but, you know, my dad wanted to look at it. I think we were the last ones on the lake, and my dad didn't want to give up. My dad loved Mike.
Brian leaned over and put his head down into his lap, sobbing. And so the judge told the court that they would take a break before resuming. When Brian took the stand again, he said he didn't want to be the one to find Mike's boat, but that his dad was determined to help with the search and to find Mike. His dad drove their boat around until they finally came across Mike's boat. The next 2 months were a blur for him, but he said he spent a lot of time at the lake. He wanted to monitor what was going on and wanted to put on a front to make it look like he was looking for Mike, like everyone else. He said he and Denise were getting concerned that nothing else was being found out there. He wanted to keep the searches focused on that area and not where he had buried the body. And so during one of his pretend searches, he threw a hat that was similar to Mike's into the water. That hat was eventually found, and he told law enforcement that it was Mike's. He said he and Denise had decided that their contact after Mike's disappearance would be minimal. When they did talk, he said he didn't want to tell Denise that their plan hadn't gone the way it was supposed to, that Mike hadn't really fallen into the water and drowned like they had planned. He said Denise had just assumed that that's what happened. He didn't tell her until years later that he had shot him. Brian said he wasn't in a hurry to cash out on Mike's life insurance and that he thought they should lay low for a while. Denise was already getting money from the insurance company and death benefit proceeds. But Brian's dad was concerned about Denise, and so he pushed the policy through so she could get the money more quickly. That's when they found out that she would need to get the death certificate issued by the court. And so they hooked Denise up with an attorney, and she filed a petition with the court to have him declared dead. About 3 years later, Brian got a call from a deputy wanting to talk about the case. He agreed and went into the police department for an interview. He said it became quite clear to him that they were suspicious of him and Denise. He said he called Denise freaking out immediately after leaving that interview. They agreed that they would never tell the police the truth about what happened. He said they were arrogantly confident in their agreement with each other. Brian told the court that Denise had been allowing her daughter to spend time with Mike's mom, but that one day she found a notebook where Mike's mom had been writing down her suspicions about Mike's death. He said Denise got really freaked out and didn't want any contact with Mike's mom after that. And because of that, they became paranoid about being monitored. They agreed to not talk on the phone about it anymore, and they would use hand signals if they wanted to go somewhere to talk about it. One symbol was a C for Mike's mom, Cheryl, and the other one mimicked a set of jail bars. When one of them used those signals, they would then go to a park, leave their phones in their vehicles, and would walk into the park to talk. He said they were very concerned that they were being watched by police. As for why he and Denise didn't get together right after Mike's disappearance, he said they knew that they couldn't because it would look bad. So he and Kathy stayed together until about 2004. He said that after Denise caught him with Angela, she decided to drop him and pursue a relationship with a man named Chuck Bunker. He said that made him angry because of all he had done for her, including kill her husband. He said eventually Denise and Chuck broke up, and he and Kathy couldn't work things out, and so he and Denise were free to be together. They decided enough time had passed, and so they started dating publicly and got married in 2005. On cross-examination, Brian was questioned about the kidnapping. He admitted he had a loaded handgun, a sheet, and an empty clip for the pistol, but said he didn't have a tarp. When Denise first got into the car, she was on the phone, so he grabbed it from her and hung it up. He said he yelled at her to drive. He doesn't remember what he screamed at her, but she was alarmed. At some point, he calmed down and realized how ridiculous the situation was. He said he was arrested on August 5th, 2016, and has been in jail ever since. He tried to get out on bond, but said Denise opposed his bond at his hearings. He was facing life in prison, but after he made his deal with prosecutors, he was ultimately sentenced to 20 years with a tentative release date of 2036. He said Denise didn't find out about him having shot Mike in the face until after he confessed to police and it came out then. He said he had tried telling her once, but she told him it was okay, that God would forgive them, that they didn't have to talk about it. Denise's attorney asked him about his behavior at his final divorce hearing with Kathy. He said he was upset, but doesn't remember telling her that he didn't want to go through with it. He said he didn't want to get back together with Kathy, but felt it was the right thing to do. Brian admitted that he was desperate to avoid going to prison, and that he had even had conversations with various people, including his sister, about helping him fabricate evidence in his kidnapping case. But he said none of the people he talked to ended up helping him. One of those people was a man named Wade Wilson, who was a hitman, and who had offered to make Denise and other witnesses go away. He said in the summer of 2017, law enforcement learned about his conversation with Wade, and it scared Brian even more. His situation was getting worse. In October 2017, the proffer agreement was negotiated.
Try to help yourself out of the situation that you had put yourself in with the armed kidnapping and with the obstruction of justice, you give to the state information related to where they can find the body of Mike Williams.
I was asked to provide any and all information that I knew about the Mike Williams case in exchange for the things that you talked about earlier.
And you got the benefits that we talked about earlier, but you got one more benefit, didn't you? You got the benefit of seeing Denise Williams arrested, locked up, and brought to trial.
That's not a benefit.
You got the revenge for her putting you in the same situation you wanted to put her in.
No, sir. I wouldn't want to put anybody in this situation. She got herself in this situation.
On redirect, Brian said that according to the agreement, he had to give testimony about what happened to Mike, and if he lied, those statements could be used against him.
It was made explicitly clear to me, particularly by the five attorneys that I had helping me on my case, that if I decided to go forth and give a proffer and give information about the Mike Williams case, that I absolutely positively needed to tell the truth, because if there was any element that was not true of what I came forward and said, then whatever I said could be used against me and the agreement would be null and void. Yes, sir.
He said that once he gets out of prison, he will be on probation for 15 years and will be monitored via a GPS system. In Florida, depending on the judge's discretion, the jury may take notes during testimony and then ask witnesses questions. So in this case, the jury had three questions for Brian. The first question was if he had ever been on any medications, to which he said no. The second question was about the insurance proceeds and whether there was a plan to pay out the money between him and Denise. Brian said that in total, Denise would be receiving about $2.2 million and that she was the beneficiary on everything. But, he said, they both knew that he would benefit too after they got together. The last question was also about the insurance money. He was asked if the insurance money was an incentive for the plot or simply a bonus. He responded that he would characterize it as a bonus and that they wanted to be together either way. Money was the icing on the cake, he said. A friend of Brian's named Stephen Mnookin then took the stand and testified that on August 5th, 2016, after Brian had kidnapped Denise, but before his arrest, Brian called him and told him that he had hit a new low and wanted to talk with him over lunch. So they met up and Brian told him what happened when he had kidnapped Denise. Brian then told him why he had done it.
Did he indicate to you at lunch, what was the catalyst for him performing that criminal act, that kidnapping?
He said that on the night, on Thursday night, the night before, the police came to his house and said that they've been talking to Denise, and once Denise gets divorced, she is going to talk to the police about what really happened to Mike Williams.
And what did that mean to Brian Winchester? What did he...
Well, it made him very nervous, and he really wanted to talk to her about it. And he kept calling her, but she wouldn't answer. So he decided that the best way to talk to her would be to kidnap her.
So that lunch, Brian Winchester indicated to you that Denise Williams was aware of something going on with the disappearance of Mike Williams?
Yes.
And that prompted him to kidnap her?
Yes.
So they could discuss it further?
Yes.
A friend of Mike's named Lindsay Lockhart testified that she went to a Sister Hazel concert with some friends, including Mike, Brian, and Denise, in the fall of 1997. She recalled seeing something odd that night.
I remember at one point, myself, Mike, and Angela were at the bar, and I looked over and saw Brian and Denise together, and Brian was standing behind Denise with his arms around her waist. And it struck me as very odd because Mike was married to Denise.
She said she remembers telling her parents about it the next day. She said that if she didn't know any better, she would have thought Brian was married to Denise and not Mike. Angela Stafford, a former coworker and friend of Mike's, testified that she too went to that Sister Hazel concert in the fall of 1997. She said Brian and Denise were, quote, very hands-on each other and very friendly with each other. She said Mike wasn't normally a drinker, but she recalled seeing him drink that night for the first time ever. In 2004, she, Denise, and Brian were supposed to go out for drinks. Denise ended up canceling, and so Angela and Brian went out and then eventually became intimate that night. Denise walked in and saw them and then left. Brian followed her. She said Denise wasn't as friendly with her after that, almost as if she had done something wrong. An investigator who helped with Brian's plea agreement testified that after Brian gave his statement, he told them he would show them where he buried Mike. So they went to Carr Lake, On the way there, Brian was uptight, but on the way back, after showing them the area, Brian remarked, "This is a relief." Dr. Lisa Flanagan, a medical examiner, testified that she examined Mike's body after it had been found. She said there were a number of skull fractures and numerous birdshot pellets in the skull. The cause of death, she said, was a shotgun shot to the head or facial area. A special agent with the FDLE, William Michler, testified about his agency's efforts to trick Denise into saying something incriminating. He said that in October of 2017, they attempted to do what's known as a bump, or a controlled contact with Denise and an informant or undercover agent. An undercover agent named Chuck went to Denise's place of employment at Florida State University and intentionally bumped into her in the parking lot. He approached her and said something like, "My name is Chuck, and I served time in jail with Mike." But they didn't quite get the reaction they wanted. Denise screamed, "Get away from me," and then went inside the building where she worked and called the Florida State University police. Agent Michler said he had to tell them about their operation. He told the jury that at another time, another agent placed a note on Denise's car, a note which she then turned into police. At some point, Agent Michler said they recruited Kathy Thomas, Brian's ex-wife and Denise's friend, to be a confidential informant. He said they conducted controlled calls, where the source is given parameters on what should be discussed, and then the call is recorded. This was in mid-January 2018 through February 2018, just 3 months before she was arrested. Sergeant Richard Wooten from the FSU Police Department testified that he was contacted by the FDLE, who informed him about the operation they were doing on Denise. They told him that if she ever called them, that he should take charge of the investigation. He said he spoke with Denise several times and noted that she was cooperative and was very interested in getting to the bottom of who had approached her in the parking lot. Nick Williams, Mike Williams' brother, then testified for the state. He spoke about his brother and said he misses him all the time. He said their mother, Cheryl, never believed the alligator theory and that he helped her try to get the investigation reopened. He said she wrote letters to the governor, contacted the FDLE, held up posters at different places, paid for billboards, and basically did anything she could to get his name out there. He described to the jury a confrontation that he and his mom had with Denise about 6 months after Mike's disappearance.
6 months after Mike disappeared, so it was summer of 2001, we got a call. She was not happy. She wanted to see both of us. Mom wasn't driving at that point, so we went to her house.
Okay. And both you and Miss Cheryl?
Yes.
When you arrived at Denise's house, was anybody else there?
Not on the first occasion. All I remember is her.
Okay. What was that?
She wasn't happy about the newspaper article that had, Mom had finally had some success and got a little blurb, a little article in the Democrat talking about Mike and what Mom was doing to try to get some more attention to the case, get an investigation going. She said at the time she did not.
Who's she?
Denise. Said she didn't want to hear his name again, didn't want to see anything in the paper about him again, that didn't want to know anything that Mom was doing about Mike. She needed to get on with her life.
He said she was very angry and that she didn't want to hear anything about Mike again. It was to the point where she was yelling at them and trying to discourage them from seeking publicity or trying to get the FDLE to investigate. He said they were stunned that she would react that way. They thought that she would want to try and find Mike, too. Cheryl Williams, Mike's mom, testified about another confrontation they had with Denise. This one was years later.
It was January 8, 2005. Nick and I were at the restaurant eating lunch. She called Nick on his cell phone. And she said, "What time is Cheryl going to be at home?" Nick said, 2 o'clock. She said, "Well, I'm coming over." The next day was January 9th. I thought that she was going to bring the baby to see me for my birthday. We had not seen her since Halloween in 2004.
Let me stop you right there. So your birthday is the very next day?
It was the very next day, January 9th.
And if I understood you correctly, the last time you saw Ainsley before then was Halloween.
Halloween of 2004.
Okay, so it was October. So from October to January, you hadn't seen her?
Right.
Okay, and this is the day before your birthday?
It was the day before my birthday, January 8th.
Okay, what happened next?
Nick and I got home, and Denise came. She knocked on the door. We opened the door, and Brian was with her.
Brian being Brian Winchester?
Brian Winchester. And I asked her, I said, where's Ainsley? Because I thought she was bringing Ainsley to see me. And she said, Ainsley's taking a nap. Well, we invited her inside, and she sat down at the table across from me. Nick was standing, and Brian had his back to the door.
And what did Denise tell you?
Denise said, Cheryl, you know that Ainsley and I love you, but Brian and I don't like the lies you're telling about us. And I looked at her and I said, Denise, what lies are you talking about? Brian screamed, you shut your mouth and let her talk. Nick got upset and said some not nice things to Brian. And then Denise is crying, and she says, Cheryl, if you will just stop this investigation, you can see Ainsley again. And I told her, I said, Denise, I can't stop this investigation. I wouldn't if I could. Nick said, Denise, Mike is Mama's son and my brother, and we just want to know what you and Brian did to him. Brian said, Denise, let's go. We're not getting anywhere. And they left.
Did you ever see Ainsley again?
No. Not at my house.
Kathy Thomas, Brian's ex-wife, testified that in the late 1990s, she suspected that Brian and Denise were having an affair. She told of a time in December 1999 when she received a phone call from a Tallahassee police officer who said he was standing next to her husband's truck, which had been abandoned in a church parking lot. She said Brian had told her he was in Arkansas hunting, so she was confused as to why the truck would be there. She noted that the church was close to Denise's house. Then, in the spring of 2000, she described a trip to Panama City that the four of them, she and Brian and Denise and Mike, were supposed to go on for Denise's 30th birthday. She said Mike ended up not going, and she felt like the third wheel with Brian and Denise. They ended up going to a strip club together, but she doesn't specifically remember everything that happened that weekend. At another time, she said she found two used movie tickets for The Virgin Suicides in Brian's wallet. She knew she hadn't gone to see the movie, so that raised her suspicions as well. Then, in July of 2001, she found a receipt from the Gold Center in Brian's office. It was for a gold necklace with the name Meridian on it, which was Denise's nickname in their group of friends. She said she and Brian separated about a month later. In August of 2016, about a week after Brian had been arrested for kidnapping Denise, Denise asked her to give a message to Brian's father, Marcus, to then pass on to Brian, who was sitting in jail.
She wanted me to tell Marcus to tell Brian that she wasn't talking.
After that, Kathy said she started talking to Agent Michler and agreed to start working as a confidential informant for them. The recordings between Kathy and Denise were played in court. In one call, Kathy said the plan was to say that she had received a subpoena from Officer Devaney to come in and talk about the case. She tells Denise in the phone call that she's freaking out about it, because a few years back, Brian had called her, upset after he had gotten into a confrontation with Denise's boyfriend, Chuck. She says that Brian, quote, told her about Mike, and that afterwards, Brian's dad, Marcus, told her not to say anything.
He called you upset about Chuck, and then he wanted to talk about Mike.
He was mad at you.
And so he told me about what happened to Mike.
Well, I would love to know what happened to Mike. He never told me. They said they found his remains and that he was beaten or that he was shot.
Brian told me that y'all planned it.
Planned what? Oh my God.
And Marcus showed up at the shop later that afternoon, you know, telling me how I would have to take this to my grave, that it would ruin Stafford's life, you know. Apparently Brian told Marcus that he had talked to me, and he went on to just tell me, Marcus went on to tell me how my life would be ruined, how I would never be able to start over, if Stafford's life was ruined, if...
So Marcus knew? And when you said Brian said y'all, you're talking about me and Brian or Marcus or who?
You and Brian. And whenever...
And that Marcus is involved? I mean, obviously, if he came and talked to you.
Well, it was just the whole, you know, shut down. So, you know, whenever...
Kathy then brings up the message Denise wanted her to give to Marcus about how Denise wasn't going to talk. But when that doesn't elicit any kind of incriminating response, she tells Denise that she's worried that her current husband, Rocky, never would have married her if he had known that she knew what happened to Mike.
Well, I mean, I know that you know something, Denise, because whenever I was going out to see Marcus, you're like, tell Marcus to tell Brian I'm not talking.
Yeah.
And I knew what that meant.
Well, that's why, because what they've been doing is they've been lying to me and they've been lying to them. And obviously, I mean, because you told me the thing about him saying what I wrote in the letter to the judge, which I didn't. And so they're playing everybody against each other.
Here's the thing. I don't even care about all that anymore because time has moved on. Mike is in heaven. So here is my problem. Here is, like, my problem. If Rocky doesn't know any of this, Rocky doesn't know that I know in all these years, anytime anything ever came up about Mike, I just sit with my mouth shut. He never would have married me if he had known.
This has nothing to do with you.
I have been lying to him for 15 years.
But you're talking about something, Chuck, happened years later. So then you're saying that years later, Brian told you something, Marcus came to you, so two people came to you to talk to you about this years after it happened. Had you met Rocky then?
Yes.
I mean, but what that has to do with is two people telling you something. That has nothing to do with you and anything that you did or anything that you didn't do. You know, I mean, it doesn't.
In the recordings, Denise never says anything implicating herself. She just tells Kathy not to worry about it and says that Kathy didn't do anything wrong, that Brian and his dad had just told her something that Kathy has nothing to do with. On cross-examination, Kathy admitted that she never caught Brian and Denise in the act, but said that she had suspicions that they were having an affair. The jury had questions for Kathy, too. One of them asked if anything about Denise or Brian's behaviors stuck out to her on the day Mike disappeared, and she said she recalled receiving a phone call from Denise around lunchtime saying that she was looking for Mike, and that Brian ended up being late to their family Christmas party. They were supposed to be there by 3 p.m., and when he still wasn't home from his hunting trip by 2 p.m., she said she left without him. Brian showed up later after they had opened their presents. As for Mike, she said it seemed as if Mike had gone hunting and hadn't come back, and other than that, nothing was unusual. When asked if Denise appeared to be emotionally distraught after Mike's disappearance, she said no. After Kathy's testimony, the state then rested. The defense called an attorney from Miami to the stand, who was employed by Mike Williams' estate. He said Brian's dad contacted him and told him that his son's best friend had disappeared and that in order for his wife to get access to their insurance policies, they needed a death certificate. He met with Brian, Brian's dad, and Denise about it and said that Denise was quiet and had her head down during the entire meeting. The two men were driving the meeting, he said. A friend of Mike's who knew Mike, Brian, and Denise from grade school testified that he thought Mike and Denise had a very happy marriage. He said Mike never complained about it and that he seemed absolutely thrilled when they had their daughter. He described Mike as always seeming perfectly content. He was also friends with Brian and said they used to go mountain biking and fishing together. He said that in July of 2016, he and Brian went fishing and that he seemed to be in good spirits, the same as all the other times they hung out. Mike Phillips was also a friend of Mike and Denise's from childhood, and he knew of Brian. He recalled seeing Brian at Lake Seminole a few days after Mike's disappearance, but he couldn't corroborate Brian's testimony that he had seen him at Walmart on the day Mike disappeared. He said he didn't recall that, nor did he recall telling Brian later that he had looked panicked. Denise decided not to testify. In his closing arguments, Assistant State's Attorney John Fuchs put a PowerPoint presentation on the screen and went over the things the jury knows for sure about the case. He said they know that Mike Williams was murdered and that he was murdered by Brian. He said they know that Brian had been in love with Denise for a long time and that Brian and Denise had gotten married in December 2005, 13 days from Denise and Mike's wedding anniversary. He said they know that Mike had multiple life insurance policies, all of which Denise was the sole beneficiary of, and that the $1 million policy was drafted by Brian the summer prior to the murder. The question you have, he said to the jury, is how does Denise fit into the murder? He brought up the testimony from Brian's friend, Stephen Mnookin, who said that Brian had specifically told him after the kidnapping that he had kidnapped Denise because she was about to tell the police what she knows about Mike's murder. That was prior to his arrest, he said. He brought up the message that Denise had asked Kathy to give to Brian's dad. Quote, tell Marcus to tell Brian that I didn't say anything. He said those two facts prove that she was an accessory after the fact. For the conspiracy charge, he admitted that they would have to rely on Brian's testimony, but said his testimony was corroborated. He said Denise also had the motive. Follow the money, he said. Brian wasn't the beneficiary, she was, and she only waited 19 days before she applied to get the money. 19 whole days. That's a cold individual. That's a person involved in a homicide, he said. As for how Denise is guilty of the actual murder, he said she is, by law, a principal. Quote, if the defendant helped another person or persons commit the crime of first-degree murder, the defendant is a principal and must be treated as if she had done all the things the other person did. He said Denise had a conscious intent that the crime be committed and said that she encouraged and assisted Brian in committing that crime. He added that according to the law, to be a principal, she does not have to be present when the crime is committed. She is, in fact, a principal, he said. He also asked the jury to consider her lack of emotion as the evidence was presented. In his closing arguments, Denise's attorney, Ethan Way, asked the jury to remove any taint of Brian Winchester from the evidence they heard. If you take Brian Winchester out of the things that have been presented to you, you have nothing, he said. He told the jury that there's no tangible evidence that implicates Denise in Mike's murder. He said this case was investigated over numerous years by numerous agencies. The government always thinks that it's the spouse, he said. They're always the suspect. But take out Brian Winchester, and what do you have? He said you have a couple concert tickets. You have testimony that in 1998, Angela went out with Brian, and the next morning, Denise gave her a dirty look. You have testimony of a truck parked at a church. But that wasn't Denise's, he said. And he pointed out that Angela had lived nearby too, and Brian could have been with her. All of that didn't amount to anything. Everything presented by the state, standing on its own, doesn't prove anything. He then addressed the kidnapping again. He said Brian was going to do God knows what to Denise with a tarp and a gun. And then he questioned why, if Brian really knew this deep, dark secret about Denise having planned her husband's murder, why would Denise then go to the police and turn him in? And if she ever had any suspicions that Brian had killed Mike, wouldn't she have turned him into the police for that? He said the state bought Brian's story, but that the jury doesn't have to. After deliberating for 8 hours, the jury returned with their verdict.
State of Florida versus Denise Williams, we the jury find as follows: as to count one of the indictment, the defendant is guilty of conspiracy to commit first degree murder. As to count two, we the jury find the defendant is guilty of first degree murder. We the jury find as follows: as to count three of the indictment, the defendant is guilty of accessory after the fact of first degree murder.
Guilty of all charges. And since she was convicted of murder, she will face an automatic life sentence. After the trial, Denise's attorneys filed three motions, one asking for a new trial, another one seeking an acquittal, and a third requesting to interview six of the jurors. In the motion asking for a new trial, Ethan Way wrote that there isn't enough evidence to support a guilty verdict, and said they have concerns about how the prosecutor told the jury to consider Denise's lack of emotion during the trial. In their motion to interview six of the jurors, they referenced a news story from after the trial that indicated that one of the jurors said they considered Denise's demeanor and reaction in their verdict. Denise is scheduled to be officially sentenced in February. As always, I'd love to hear what you think about this case. Do you think Denise was involved in the planning of Mike's murder? Did you find Brian's testimony to be credible? Do you think you would have convicted if you were on the jury? You can let me know by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com or tweeting me at courtjunkiepod. And just a reminder, if you'd like to hear these episodes early and ad-free, please consider donating as little as $1 a month by going to courtjunkie.com/support. This will redirect you to my Patreon page. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.